Today on Against the Grain, how should a socialist revolution unfold? Is it up to the working class only to topple the system, or should workers act as the left wing of a broader movement to change the status quo? Marx, Engels, and a host of radical thinkers who followed them grappled with these questions. I'm C.S. Emanuele Saccarelli explores some of the debates around the concept of the permanent revolution and reflects on their relevance today, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. The French Revolution made a deep impression, understandably, on all sorts of political thinkers, including Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. So when Marx and Engels wrote their Communist Manifesto, they were guided to a significant extent by what had transpired in France beginning in 1789. But what occurred in the revolutions that shook Europe in 1848 and 1849, just after the manifesto was published, was very different than how the French Revolution unfolded, and that led Marx and Engels to change and adapt their understanding. And it also led subsequent socialist thinkers to read and interpret the manifesto in different ways. Emanuele Saccarelli has written about some of the debates that arose around how a socialist revolution could or should be carried out, whether workers should first fight alongside the capitalist class against, you could say, the enemies of its enemies, or whether the working class should shun any alliance with the capitalist class or bourgeoisie. Emanuele Saccarelli is an associate professor of political science at San Diego State University and the author of Gramsci and Trotsky in the Shadow of Stalinism. He also contributed an essay entitled The Permanent Revolution in and Around the Manifesto to the Cambridge Companion to the Communist Manifesto, edited by Terrell Carver and James Farr. When Emanuele Saccarelli joined me from a studio in San Diego, I first asked him to discuss the importance of the Communist Manifesto as an historical and a political document.
The Manifesto is an immensely important political document, not so much at the time of its writing and publication. Although even then, it had a definite, let's say, prophetic quality that anticipated many of the things that actually happened and then continue to happen, as a matter of fact, down to today. But eventually, with the rise of Marxism as a movement, not simply as a series of ideas, as a political movement, the Manifesto very quickly emerged as a very significant founding text for that particular tradition, due in large part to its remarkable intrinsic quality as a text. It's an incredibly moving work that has an energy and a power that is really rare to find. And I think it also speaks very powerfully to contemporary conditions as well.
The Communist Manifesto was published in February 1848. What prompted Marx and Engels to write it?
This is itself an interesting story because Marx and Engels are often sort of taken as part of the history of Western political thought, you know, from Plato to through various characters, and they're certainly part of that. But they also represent, let's say, a new type of intellectual, which is not Plato, and it's not Machiavelli or Locke. They were people who were very directly and militantly involved in political struggle in ways that the philosophers of the older period were not, typically, with some exceptions. And so what prompted them to write this text was a political series of events, and namely the appearance of an organization of workers called the Communist League, which formed. It used to be called the League of the Just, and in 1847 the Communist League came about, consisting largely of workers, and they required a political program and a series of conceptions of what it is that they would fight for, and enter Marx and Engels as, at some level, ordinary intellectuals who went through the usual circuits of university and dissertation, etc. But by this time, they had decisively cast their lot with ordinary working people, and then really oriented their own talents and skills and sacrifices and efforts to this new cause, which was represented by ordinary working people. So they were essentially commissioned to write this text to give principles and guidance to the Communist League.
Now, as you write in this essay in the Cambridge Companion, you write, "The manifesto does two things. It offers a theory of historical development, of the unfolding of history, and it addresses how to act, how to take action politically." Elaborate on those two facets of the document.
This too somewhat corresponds to what I just discussed in terms of it operates as a somewhat conventional, big idea type of text in the history of Western political thought. So it has a very definite explanation of the historical process and politics and political struggle and the composition of society, the nature of the state, the increasingly international character of all of these processes and questions. In other words, it seeks to explain how the world and society in particular functions. And then side by side with that as a manifesto, it also very much encourages and sets itself up as a political intervention in the present. And therefore, it has definite programmatic demands. It is a manifesto in the ordinary sense of political parties today, which fight for definite things as opposed to other parties and rival programs and conceptions. So that kind of dual nature is itself very interesting. The programmatic demands are not purely pragmatic. It's not just they don't emerge arbitrarily. They emerge rather out of the explanation of how society functions and where history is headed. Or flipping that around, the theory of historical development is not purely contemplative or passive, but it identified very precisely a link in the chain of history at which actual human pressure can be exerted and political action can take place.
So there are so many things that could be said about the manifesto and have been said. You in this essay have chosen to focus on some debates around a concept, a term called the permanent revolution. And let's start with what Marx and Engels meant when they used the term.
This concept is a very significant political concept. When they originally used it, it wasn't really a concept so much as a historical allusion when they were talking in particular about the nature of the great French Revolution. And there they used this term of permanent revolution to refer to the fact that starting in 1789, the revolutionary process had a series of very interesting and sharp twists and turns. For a time, it kept going more and more to the left, and it began simply as a rejection of the monarchy, or at least a rejection of the latest demands on the part of the monarchy by the Third Estate. And then it developed more and more radically and in a revolutionary manner down to the Jacobins and their government in 1793, 1794. So this was permanent revolution attempted to capture this idea that within the same set of events, there were multiple revolutionary surges and dynamics. Then, after the actual historical experience of 1848-49, there were a series of revolutions throughout continental Europe. Marx and Engels began to really use the same term in a different way. Suddenly, it became an actual political concept. And what they meant generally was that although much of the world still required what they called a bourgeois democratic revolution, because the old hierarchies and state forms of old, the characteristic of feudalism and absolutism, were still around. And the bourgeoisie, the capitalist class, was supposed to go through this script of the great French Revolution and overthrow all those archaic political forms and replace them with modern, let's say, liberal and democratic forms, parliaments, constitutions, etc. Marx and Engels began to notice that the capitalist class became more and more hesitant, reluctant, and then actively hostile to that prospect. And therefore, that meant that even the basic bourgeois democratic rights of liberalism and constitutionalism, that began to fall more on the backs of the modern working class. That even though the working class was or should have been oriented towards socialism well beyond the somewhat narrow parameters of bourgeois democracy, the working class had to sort of be the protagonist for this entire process, from breaking down what was left of feudalism and absolutism through the experience of modern sort of bourgeois state all the way through socialism. So permanent revolution was a sort of compression of historical stages that before the experience of the mid-19th century were regarded as really distinct. First, a kind of a decades of bourgeois democracy, and then eventually the fight for socialism. Permanent revolution meant that that process would be combined and compressed.
His name is Emanuele Saccarelli. He is associate professor of political science at San Diego State University, and he contributed an essay entitled The Permanent Revolution in and Around the Manifesto to the Cambridge Companion to the Communist Manifesto. It's published by Cambridge University Press. So you were talking about what Marx and Engels observed, what they noticed about what was happening in 1848, 1849, throughout Europe, all these revolutions and upheavals. What had they said in the Communist Manifesto about the degree to which the proletariat, the working class, would need to depend on the capitalist class, would need to work, in some senses, with the bourgeoisie in order to achieve their ultimate goals?
Yes, what they said in the manifesto was somewhat, let's say, provisional, and it had a political line, but I think it's also clear in reading the document that one would have to test it on the grounds of what would actually happen in the course of the revolutionary process. The general line seems to be that the working class basically for a time would have to fight not its enemy, the capitalist class, but the enemy of its enemy. That is to say, these remnants of feudalism, absolutism, monarchies, the aristocracy, all these archaic forces. And then and to fight against those side by side with the bourgeoisie, having vanquished those forces, then the real struggle for socialism could take place on a higher historical plane of bourgeois democracy, again, constitutions, liberalism, rights, etc. However, they also very clearly make the point that even though this class alliance would be necessary, there are certain important qualifications in the manifesto. One of them is that they insisted that we should fight with the capitalist class whenever it acts in a progressive and revolutionary manner, suggesting that when it doesn't, then we shouldn't go in that direction. So that was one important qualification to that.
Could you talk more, Emanuele, about how the bourgeoisies in Europe, how they conducted themselves during the revolution, the revolutions of 1848-49, such that Marx and Engels and many radical thinkers and revolutionaries lost faith in the bourgeoisie and its ability to provide a kind of spur to the eventual working class revolution?
Yes. As I said earlier, apparently the template was there. The bourgeoisie was simply meant to kind of carry out the same general script as had taken place in 1789 France. That is to say, a fight in a very revolutionary and principled manner against monarchy, let's say, what was left of feudalism, aristocracy, etc. What happened in 1848-49 throughout Europe was of a very different character. First of all, it was not the capitalist class that really initiated this wave of revolutionary movements. It was actually popular layers, workers, or what Marx called the petite bourgeoisie. Wealthy people were not initiating these revolutionary processes, and once they began, they very quickly took a somewhat equivocal position. Their basic political thinking went something like this. They would have much preferred to have bourgeois democracy over various forms of monarchical political rule. But they were also very concerned that, unlike in 1789 in France, by 1848-49, there was in fact a modern working class. The process of industrialization is typically dated to be complete around that time. There were large factories and the modern proletariat existed. In the face of that reality, the bourgeoisie began to get cold feet when it came to these revolutionary struggles, because they simply could not be certain that they could control fully the revolutionary process. They could perhaps control where it began, but they had no assurances that they could control where it would end. And texts like the Communist Manifesto already, in a sense, put them on notice that if the feudal order and the monarchies were to fall, next on the agenda it would be them. And so these people, of course, were not stupid. They understood that there was a countervailing factor now in the world of politics. Their revolutionary enthusiasm of 1789 was dampened by the presence of the working class. And Marx has other texts in which he brilliantly exposes their cowardly behavior, their hesitations, their timid orientation toward the monarchy, and ultimately really that they actually cut a political deal with the old order, preferring that to rolling the dice on a revolutionary process that, as I said earlier, may not end too well for them. And so all of these revolutionary events that swept the great cities of Europe, Rome, I'm from Rome, the Pope, fell and was replaced briefly by a republic, Vienna, Berlin, Paris, of course. All of these cities went through an actual revolutionary uprising in which the workers played a leading role, in which the bourgeoisie reluctantly participated and then pulled back. And the case of Paris is perhaps the most instructive case, because there's a revolution in February 1848, then there's a second revolution in June, and the bourgeoisie intervenes in that second revolution very directly to basically wipe out the workers from their barricades. So they literally are on the other side of the barricades. People like Alexis de Tocqueville, for example, who represented them, are fighting on the other side of the barricades, and they would eventually feel far more comfortable with an accommodation with the monarchy than with the processes they were witnessing throughout Europe.
Let's talk about one of the thinkers you focus on in your essay in the Cambridge Companion to the Communist Manifesto, and that is Karl Kautsky, a theoretician, a journalist, prominent radical thinker. I think he was Czech-Austrian, born in 1854. What did he say about the prediction of Marx and Engels in the manifesto that there would be kind of a bourgeois revolution followed by a proletarian revolution?
This is, of course, a complicated story. To set it up, I suppose the first thing to note is that by the time Kautsky was writing, Marxism really had become a mass organized political movement. He was a member of the mass working class party, the Social Democracy of Germany. He was its leading intellectual. So in a certain sense, if the manifesto could issue a series of prophecies that would begin to come about later, by this time, let's say the turn of the century, 19th to the 20th, the political concreteness of communism was far more visible. And so Kautsky is writing as really a leader of the mass movement. His attitude toward the permanent revolution and what was in the manifesto was very interesting. Often, Marxism is taken to be a sort of a dogma or series of religious beliefs that are simply to be memorized and preached. Kautsky has a different attitude, like all the actual Marxists of the time and perhaps down to today. He understood Marxism as a method to analyze the world as it existed, not as a fully finished, ready-made set of formulas. So one of the things he writes is something that poses a very impertinent question, is to what extent is the Communist Manifesto obsolete? Certainly doesn't give the sense of a kind of a religious dogma. He really wanted to think through 50 years of actual political and economic development in Germany as well as the world and test and verify the extent to which one could say that the manifesto was still accurate. Of course, the manifesto for him was plenty accurate in the broad strokes, you know, the class nature of the state, that he was not a neutral institution. It was a series of institutions controlled by a definite layer of society, a class. The general sequence of historical development, which we gestured toward earlier, he thought that was, of course, correct. The part that was to be reassessed was exactly the issue that a permanent revolution points to, which is to say, what can we expect out of the bourgeoisie in Germany or in other countries? For example, in Russia. And on that score, Kautsky expressed very substantial reservations that the old script of 1789 France could be simply replicated and reproduced. And this is, of course, because capitalism, particularly in countries like Germany and Russia, where it came late, the sequence of event meant that the bourgeoisie was of a somewhat different character. The French bourgeoisie had a heroic period and a suitably heroic series of great figures like Danton and Robespierre and Voltaire and Rousseau and people of that nature. The German bourgeoisie was a different animal. And certainly the Russian bourgeoisie was a different animal. The old hero, the heroes of the bourgeoisie were no longer visible, only very intellectually somewhat pitiful and politically very passive types represented the bourgeoisie. So Kautsky basically, not categorically, but begins to grope in the direction of this idea of permanent revolution, meaning that it's going to be up to the working class to even carry out the political objectives that are historically associated with the capitalist class. And then as it does that, what would happen is that this struggle would very quickly fold into a struggle for socialism. Kautsky is usually not associated with this idea because eventually he would become quite a conservative figure and play a somewhat different role later on, especially after the Russian Revolution. But it is part of this book titled Witness to the Permanent Revolution, edited by Richard Day and Daniel Guido, which I use in my work, which really shows that the permanent revolution had a broader, let's say, origin and application. Later on, it becomes associated, rightly, with Leon Trotsky, who was a very prominent figure in the Russian Revolution and an opponent of Stalinism. But there was a kind of an underbrush of important Marxist figures who were, although not as explicitly and directly in finished form as Trotsky, they were beginning to rethink some of these, to rethink the template. And Kautsky was a very prominent version of that type of rethinking.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Emanuele Saccarelli joins me. He teaches political science at San Diego State. He's the author of Gramsci and Trotsky and the Shadow of Stalinism. And we are talking about an essay he wrote that he contributed to the Cambridge Companion to the Communist Manifesto that's edited by Terrell Carver and James Farr. We have a link to Professor Saccarelli and to the Cambridge Companion on our website, againstthegrain.org. How concerned was Karl Kautsky that some readers of the manifesto would and did use the assertion in that document that the working class has to fight together with the bourgeoisie, that those readers, those interpreters of the manifesto would push a kind of reformist rather than a revolutionary agenda.
Yes, he was very concerned. He noticed a certain mood in the German SPD, a tendency.
Social Democratic Party.
Yes, of Germany. He noticed a mood of conservatism, a mood of accommodation with the status quo and certainly with the bourgeoisie. And he, for a time, fought against this. And his comments on the permanent revolution are exactly an expression of that, a fight against this conservative tendencies. This struggle against what would be known as revisionism took up a great deal of time and energy on the part of people like Kautsky, and also another famous participant in this was Rosa Luxemburg. And Kautsky was extremely worried about this turn of events. And therefore, he went back to the manifesto, among other texts, to sort of make this point. And it was not just a point about what's in the manifesto, but really it was a point about what is Marxism and to what extent can one simply rely on canonical texts as opposed to an analysis of the concrete situation on the ground to advance the cause of socialism. So in looking at Germany, but also in looking at Russia, he noticed, rightly, that capitalism had been around for decades and very modern industry had been installed in certainly in Germany, but also more and more in Russia as well. And yet, the political superstructure in this country was not changing. Certainly, Germany didn't have a proper liberal democracy. He had a very curious parliamentary system with a Kaiser on top of that. And of course, Russia had a Tsar, the most archaic and really quite awful of all of these political forms. And so why was that the case? And Kautsky begins to think that the German and the Russian bourgeoisie may not have particular interest in overthrowing those types of institutions and establishing a proper bourgeois democracy. And he sees this very clearly in the actual political behavior of these people. If you think about Russia, I mean, an extremely wealthy capitalist in Russia would look at the Tsar and say, well, of course, I don't particularly enjoy the absence of freedom of the press and freedom of assembly. Perhaps that person would be, at some level, still inspired by the great slogans of the French Revolution. But the reality is that the Tsar is a very useful political instrument, because when the workers go on strike, and in Russia they would more and more and more militantly, the Tsar has some nice features, very attractive features, a secret police to infiltrate the workers' movement, a massive body of armed men to crush them in the streets when that's necessary. And so from the standpoint of the bourgeoisie, these archaic forms are actually more and more regarded as not just a wart on the body politic, but more and more as a real necessity. And by the way, this is true to this day. I don't think these are just issues of historical significance. When one looks, for example, at countries like in the Middle East, like Egypt or Saudi Arabia, and one thinks about, well, those are definitely capitalist countries. And yet the political superstructure is quite archaic. Why is that? Well, it's because of the reasons that Kautsky began to formulate.
You mentioned Leon Trotsky, who, of course, got into a rather severe disagreement with Stalin with terrible consequences for his political career and his life. What did Trotsky mean by permanent revolution?
I just begin by noting simply that, of course, the fight between Trotsky and Stalin, yes, it had terrible consequences for Trotsky's career, but I'm tempted to say that it actually had terrible consequences for humanity at large, insofar as the banner of communism began to be associated with the behavior of the bureaucracy in the Soviet Union headed by Stalin. But Trotsky's role was really quite unique at this time in the international movement of Marxism. He was the one, as I suggested earlier, that was really the most... He pushed this notion of the permanent revolution down to its kind of most fully formed expression. Whereas people like Kautsky and others sort of were thinking about this could not really come to a categorical conclusion about the fact that the period of a revolutionary and progressive bourgeoisie was over. Trotsky really, really boldly stated this. And this, of course, would have enormous implications for the actual historical development in places like Russia, as well as the world, really, because this was a matter of the highest political significance. The worker movement, according to Trotsky, could not play auxiliary role for a progressive bourgeoisie with an eye to establishing a bourgeois democracy, and then after that, take up the fight for socialism. The bourgeoisie was simply no longer a progressive force, and that lesson had to be digested. It was already the lesson of 1848, 1849, and yet wide sections of the Marxist movement had not really come to grips with it. Trotsky was the one who stressed this most sharply and without equivocation.
So we have Kautsky, we have Trotsky, we have many others saying that, you know, to say that the proletariat would have to serve as kind of the left wing, the radical wing of the bourgeois revolution, no longer made sense. And it makes me wonder how some thinkers could think of the manifesto as, you know, being so predictive such that it had a kind of a dogmatic quality. In other words, wouldn't it be logical, like Kautsky asserted, wouldn't it be logical that Marx and Engels could not foresee even what would happen in 1848, 1849? I mean, it's not like they had a crystal ball and they could somehow lay out the future unfolding of the revolution or the lack thereof for eventual followers.
Yes, it would be logical, definitely. And actually, if someone were to simply follow Marx and Engels' views already by 1850, they're really on record. There's a text called the 1850 Address to the Central Committee of the Communist League, which actually ends with a call for the revolution in permanence. And the content of that text is basically to register the fact that the bourgeoisie betrayed us, that this class behaved in a reactionary manner in those revolutionary waves, and therefore it's time to draw those conclusions. That's the same, of course, the same conclusion in the famous 18th Brumaire of Napoleon Bonaparte, which is another brilliant text written by Marx. It's the same basic idea. So even a somewhat sort of literal follower of Marx would have had to kind of come to this conclusion. But, you know, as you rightly point out, the point of Marxism was not to hand you a series of ready-made formulas, but to provide a method to understand history and political reality. And so this was not well understood. Why? It wasn't simply a failure of the intellect. For example, this conservative mood that set in Germany had a definite material foundation. There were very large trade unions, which were actually built by the Marxist Party in Germany. And these unions, after a certain point, began to realize that a revolution might have been, as a matter of fact, bad business in certain sense, because it would have disrupted a steady growth of their own position that they began to enjoy quite a bit. I'm talking about the trade union bureaucracy in this particular instance. So there were, let's say, class pressures that came to bear on sections of the Marxist movement that pushed it, or sections of it, toward an accommodation with the bourgeoisie, toward a erasure of the lesson of 1848-49. And so, as I said, it wasn't simply an intellectual misstep, but there were real interests at stake in this as well. For example, Kautsky, in writing these things about the permanent revolution, he really attracted the hostility of the trade union bureaucracy within his own party, which hated this, which really thought that it was too soon to start talking about the proletarian revolution or even a revolution at all. There was a section of the SPD, particularly Bernstein, who began to think that, you know, we don't really need a revolution, that capitalism will more or less peacefully evolve into socialism and we don't need to put our necks out to disrupt this steady evolution.
Emmanuel Saccarelli is my guest. He is Associate Professor of Political Science at San Diego State University. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with Emanuele about what he expresses and articulates in the chapter he contributed to the Cambridge Companion to the Communist Manifesto. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Emanuele Saccarelli joins us. He teaches political science at San Diego State University. He's the author of Gramsci and Trotsky in the Shadow of Stalinism, and he is co-author with Lata Varadarajan of the volume Imperialism, Past and Present, and we are talking about an essay he contributed about the permanent revolution in and around the manifesto to the Cambridge Companion to the Communist Manifesto. Another set of debates you address that you bring up in this article have to do with how capitalism would expand around the globe, and it certainly has, of course. What did the manifesto say about whether and how the capitalist system would expand beyond the places and nations in which it existed in 1847?
I think those are some of the most moving and in a certain sense correct passages of the manifesto. There are some really great striking phrases there. Their basic idea is a version of what today we could call globalization, that capitalism would not remain a insular mode of production, but would very systematically and very powerfully expand into every nook and cranny of the globe, which is, of course, precisely what happened. One of the striking phrases in the manifesto is that it would break down all Chinese walls, that any kind of national resistance, even on the part of very remarkable civilizations of a pre-capitalist character, would be systematically undermined. And if we look at China today, of course, in my view, one of the most important capitalist countries in the world, certainly crucial to the world capitalist economy, that's precisely what happened. Another interesting phrase in the manifesto is that, and this is very telling, perhaps of the limitations or problem with the general prognosis, is where they basically say that the bourgeoisie would create a world after its own image, which I take to mean that a version of this, that the original template of social and political transformation of England would be reproduced in all the countries of the world, which would also imply, of course, that the political history of England would be reproduced throughout all the countries of the world, meaning a parliament, and if not the abolition of the monarchy, certainly its substantial curtailing. And this is where I think the reality as it unfolded proved to be somewhat more complicated. Leon Trotsky, whom we talked about earlier, has this concept of uneven and combined development, which captures this. Certainly, capitalism would expand and affect every country. There would be no oasis from the effects of capitalism. But the manner in which it would expand would be somewhat contradictory. It would bring with it the latest technology, technique, modern forms of production, and of course with that, a modern working class and a capitalist class, to be sure. But at the same time, it wouldn't necessarily reproduce the English template everywhere. I mentioned earlier Saudi Arabia, for example. Maybe it's too easy, but that's a very kind of classic case where I don't know anyone who would disagree with the notion that Saudi Arabia is thoroughly integrated in the world capitalist economy, and yet its political superstructure is definitely not England. Although maybe today's England, that would be a little different. But it certainly is not a classic bourgeois democracy. It's as archaic as it gets. And capitalism expanded to the Middle East just fine without really disrupting these archaic political forms. And in some senses, actually reinforcing them and in other instances, even reinventing them. So the capitalist class begins to use all kinds of traditional and archaic forms and forces as a prop, as a necessary prop, for some of the reasons we explained earlier, because they understood that there was a danger to their left, and the proper bourgeois democracy would expose them to a series of immense political danger. Imagine what it would be like to have, for example, freedom of the press or assembly in Saudi Arabia today. You know, there's an immensely exploited workforce, and this would mean that the profit extraction process would be very difficult. Or China, I mean, similar, although there are significant historical complications there, but what do we have? It's essentially a police state, which makes sure that the multi-million Chinese working class is exploited by multinational corporations. If you allow political liberties of a classical kind in China, this would be very much asking for trouble.
So in the essay, you point to a specific debate between two Russian thinkers, David Ryazanov and Georgi Plekhanov. And as I understand it, because we don't have time to get into a lot of the detail here, but Ryazanov thought that Plekhanov placed too much emphasis on general patterns of capitalist development being reproduced in Russia. And Ryazanov was like, no, there are these national peculiarities, as you know, as you alluded to, there are these characteristics specific to where we are, where Plekhanov and Ryazanov are, that affect how capitalism develops and proceeds. Why was Ryazanov so intent on pushing this point? What was he worried that Plekhanov would do or perhaps did do with this notion that, hey, capitalism will just kind of unfold in Russia similarly to how it's unfolded in other nations?
Yes, it's a similar story to what we discussed with Kautsky earlier. Essentially, Plekhanov, although historically played a very important role, he was regarded as the father of Russian Marxism. Plekhanov didn't exactly apply the method cogently to the reality in Russia in the sense that we just explained. The actual orientation of the bourgeoisie and the actual role of the working class in that country. And so he took up a more and more conservative position, which wanted the 1789 script from France to just play out in Russia, and expected that, which meant, of course, that the Russian bourgeoisie then was expected to be progressive. And then the corollary to that politically was that the Russian working class had to effectively subordinate itself to the political agenda of the bourgeoisie to jointly fight for a bourgeois democracy. Ryazanov fought against that. Again, by picking up on these elements, embryonic elements of permanent revolution from Marx and Engels, but more importantly from the actual unfolding of events on the ground. And these were, of course, very powerful discussions and very significant debates, because even though a neutral observer might have looked at a handful of intellectuals arguing over fine matters of theory at the turn of the 20th century, the reality is that out of those debates came the Russian Revolution of 1917. And so these are not arcane and remote considerations. This was a necessary theoretical preparation for a remarkable political earthquake, which really shook not just Russia, but the world.
We've put links on againstthegrain.org to my guests. That's Emanuele Saccarelli, his faculty page at San Diego State University, where he teaches political science, as well as to the Cambridge Companion to the Communist Manifesto. That's edited by Terrell Carver and James Farr. It's published by Cambridge University Press, to which my guest contributed a really interesting essay that we're focusing on today. Now, Emanuele, you've referred to kind of the continuing impact of these debates and these concepts in the sense of, you know, today's political and social environment. Can you talk more about the relevance of the debates that you bring up in this essay, in this chapter, to what's happening today, in addition perhaps to the bourgeoisie? And again, it's kind of a shorthand for the capitalist class, the capital accumulating class, in addition to what, you know, the capitalist class, the bourgeoisie, what status it holds, what agenda it has in contemporary capitalist society?
Yes, I think this issue of permanent revolution is absolutely critical to the future of the planet, really. Again, to sort of summarize very quickly what the concept is. The concept is that in countries in which capitalism developed late, a normal bourgeois parliamentary democracy is generally not in the cards. And it's not in the cards because of this political dynamic between the capitalist class and the presence of a modern working class. But then the flip side is also that in countries which have had capitalism for a while, one could say that really some of these normal bourgeois democratic institutions are now teetering on the brink of disaster. I mean, the American bourgeoisie, for example, its attitude toward the very state and constitution they themselves created, I think nowadays is of a very different character. They're not particularly committed to it. They're in the process of violating practically every item in the Bill of Rights. They control and oversee a government which routinely violates provisions in the Bill of Rights, including but not limited to state assassinations without due process and many other things of that nature. And so this is an immensely important question. There are also recent events. I mentioned Egypt earlier, but this is a very fresh test for the basic theory of permanent revolution, which states that, again, a normal bourgeois democracy will not come about. And if we look at Egypt today, after a series of convulsions and a great deal of hope, with the masses intervening in the streets and overthrowing the dictator Mubarak, what do we have today? We're back to a military dictatorship, which has the support of the American government. This is the ABC of the permanent revolution. And if that's the case, then I hope that listeners will realize that there are immense political stakes bound up with this concept, and they should take them very seriously. If I could, maybe another quick point to this, the issue of the working class. As I said earlier, the permanent revolution posited that even if the point was simply to defend or bring about bourgeois democracy, it would be the working class that would have to carry out this work. And I think that's also a very powerful political insight. When the Communist Manifesto was written, the working class was a tiny minority of the planet's population. Today, it is, at last, the majority of the world's population. Working people have really, in my view, little interest in war and exploitation. They're the victims of that. And so if one is looking for a natural, let's say, constituency for even just bourgeois democracy and its protections and freedoms, I don't think it would be the Bill Gates of the world. It would be ordinary working people.
Well, the working class can be concerned. It can be anxious. It can be worried. It can be precarious. It can be made more and more precarious. But where in the world do you see the kind of working class militancy that might feed a kind of revolution that would change things on a fundamental level?
Effectively everywhere. One could talk about China. The Chinese working class is extremely militant. It's difficult to get these reports, but they engage in very militant strikes routinely, and the Chinese Communist Party is very concerned about that. Egypt, which I just mentioned, I mean, the revolution was certainly not a handful of middle-class kids showing up at a square, but it came about on the heel of a series of very powerful strikes that by the working class in Egypt, which affected practically every sector of the industry. And then maybe finally, I think the American working class, which is often regarded with a certain measure of contempt by people on the left, is in fact objectively, I would say, absolutely a revolutionary class. The levels of social inequality that exist in this country are unprecedented. There are very definite signs after a long period of quiescence that the American working class is moving. One could think of the Verizon strike of late, for example. And I think that everywhere one looks, the working class is definitely moving to the left in a certain sense. The Sanders phenomenon is an expression of that. If you look at France today, there are mass demonstrations practically every day and unmitigated hostility toward the bourgeois government of France and its state of emergency, which incidentally relates quite well to what I said earlier about the attitude of the bourgeoisie toward its standard ideals and practices. So I'm all of that to say that I think it's peculiar to me that this isn't part of a kind of understood common sense, that the working class is in fact moving very powerfully to the left, and that they have every interest in effectively carrying out some of the things that Marx and Engels wrote about in the Communist Manifesto.
Well, I agree with you in part, but I mean, there's been a lot of talk about workers, you know, the traditional left constituencies moving toward and cozying up with the sort of populist, nationalist, xenophobic, reactionary forces that have emerged. I mean, witness Trump. And I mean, there's an argument being made that, you know, the left and the right, it's kind of getting a little more ambiguous, and that there are a lot of people, working class people in the U.S., for example, who are backing candidates like Trump who are very, very far from the left, who are opposed to the left.
Yes, I mean, I take the point that the political landscape today is, on its terms, it simply doesn't seem to, let's say, go in the direction I was talking about. I think that the official political establishment in the U.S. and elsewhere is absolutely corrupt and rotten, but I think to implicate the working class in it, I think I'm not prepared to do that. And I think the reason why is entirely bound up with what happened in Marxism, for one. And certainly, one would have to unpack what exactly this left is. This is, of course, a complex question, but there used to be a time where working people in droves would join socialist and communist parties, including in the United States. What happened to that, in part, has to do not with the failure of the working class as a revolutionary class, but with the failure of a series of bankrupt political ideas, such as reformism or Stalinism, and the crimes, of course, committed in the name of the worker movement and Marxism. So to the extent that the working class peeled away from that, I don't think it's really their responsibility. Rather, it's the political history of the 20th century that would have to be unpacked very, very carefully to understand what happened to these ideas.
Emanuele Saccarelli, he is Associate Professor of Political Science at San Diego State University, co-author of Imperialism Past and Present, author of Gramsci and Trotsky in the Shadow of Stalinism, and you may also want to check out his essay in the Cambridge Companion to the Communist Manifesto. Thanks so much, Emanuele, for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.